You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
The way that it's handled is generally without threats of violence. That's a pretty low bar. Hi, I'm Rania Yallop.
And I'm Elfie Scott.
And welcome to Party Time, the podcast from SBS News, keeping you up to speed on what's happening in federal politics.
Rania, what has been happening this week?
Honestly, what hasn't been happening? It's been such a charged week.
Yeah, totally. I feel like I have had so many conversations with people at work, people outside of work about this, and it's been a really tough week for a lot of communities. And we're going to get into it, but maybe we should start off with one moment that got a lot of attention, and that was a heated moment with Queensland MP Bob Katter.
Yeah, well, I guess we have to. Last week, Bob Katter openly threatened to punch a journalist during a press conference for asking him about his Lebanese heritage.
Oh, mate, don't say that, because that irritates me, and I punch blokes in the mouth for saying that. Don't you dare say that. My family have been in this country for 140 years, right? So you, and if you say anything like that, I have, on many occasions, punched blokes in the mouth, right? So I'm restraining myself today. I'm an Australian. My family have been here since the dawn of time. That's the end of it.
Rania, as somebody who works in Canberra, who works around political journalists all the time, like, have you ever seen anything like this before?
No. I mean, I've never seen anything like it before. There's obviously kind of disagreement between media and politicians all the time. But I think the way that it's handled is generally without threats of violence. That's a pretty low bar, really, but that is the kind of standard way of operating, is that you can disagree with words.
Yeah, totally.
He's not apologetic either. He's actually doubled down. On Monday, he said that he'd wished he had gone further.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, look, and this story was absolutely huge, right? Like, I follow a lot of international news publications on social media, as I'm sure everybody else does. And this was one of those ones where I saw it popping up in the US, I saw it popping up in the UK. And it was, frankly, a bit embarrassing.
Yeah, and the Greens have now called on Katter to either apologise or resign, with Sarah Hanson-Young saying threats of violence have no place in Australian politics. So we'll see where this goes.
Yeah, and to attempt to give you context to all of this, at the time, Katter was expressing support for the anti-immigration rallies that happened over the weekend.
Yeah, so this has easily been the biggest story from the last week, the anti-immigration March for Australia rallies across the country.
Yeah, and look, these were advertised as anti-mass immigration rallies, but we should note that there were explicitly racist elements to these marches.
Yeah, even the material before the rallies, they singled out Indian immigrants as well.
Yeah, it's horrendous. And look, in the lead up to these marches, there were warnings from politicians. Federally, they were condemned by Labor and the Greens, while the coalition noted that there are people of goodwill with legitimate policy concerns. But they said to be careful of the company you keep, noting the promotional material had racist and anti-Semitic undertones.
Yeah. In New South Wales, Premier Chris Minns had this to say just after the rallies.
If you go into a rally and the Nazis turn up, it's not one you should be at. And no one can deny that they were there. No one can deny that racist language was used. We can have civil debates about policy issues that affect the country, but this tipped into far more than that.
During the marches, the National Socialist Network, a neo-Nazi group, was handing out flyers to people attending, and in some cities, members even spoke at the rallies.
Yeah, and then following the event in Melbourne, a sacred Indigenous site, Camp Sovereignty, was attacked, and a number of people have now been arrested for that.
Yeah, including neo-Nazi leader Thomas Sowell, who was arrested for his alleged involvement in that attack after he turned up to a press conference with Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen and making false claims about protesting rights.
So, Rania, with ties to known neo-Nazis established before the rallies and neo-Nazi leaders actually attending and speaking publicly at these marches, what is going on?
Well, to unpack some of this, we're first joined by expert in far-right extremism, Dr. Callum Jones from Monash University.
Callum, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So can I ask, What was at the heart of these March for Australia rallies? Like, what are some people feeling in the community? And why do you think that there is so much blame shifting towards immigration right now?
Yeah, the reality is that there's a handful of sort of coalescing societal factors that are making people dissatisfied and more likely to gravitate towards these kinds of movements that focus the attention of dissatisfaction onto immigration. So things like price of living, housing affordability, these kinds of societal structural issues that everyday people are experiencing can bring levels of disenfranchisement and a sense of having lost something that was previously within reach. And what the far right do, which is the, you know, the broad ideological underpinning of the March for Australia, they take legitimate social grievances that people have, things like housing affordability, things like wage stagnation and so on, and they shift that towards convenient scapegoats. And immigrants are often the scapegoats that are chosen by the far right to explain complex sociological phenomena.
You said it's kind of far right people that are behind this. Is that who actually did the organization for these rallies? Do we know who came up with the idea and kind of pushed this forward?
We do, yeah. We do know that there was a user called Beck Freedom, which is a pseudonym. She was, I guess, perceived to be one of the primary organizers. And I think that it's very telling some of the things that she has said and has been recorded saying. There is a recording of Beck Freedom saying that the goal of the rally was to focus on a preservation of Australian heritage, culture and way of life. And she very, very explicitly said that there is a linear progression from saying an Australian way of life and culture to a European way of life and culture to white life and culture. So we know that she was one of the primary organizers, and she has a very clear white supremacist agenda. And she also listed the cause for obfuscating in this way as making the rally more palatable to the mainstream and not having it dismissed as a white supremacist or neo-Nazi rally. We also know that another far-right figure, I believe Hugo Lennon, was involved. And we actually do know that a member of the National Socialist Network, which is a large neo-Nazi group based across Australia, but at least one of their members was for a period of time responsible for organising the Melbourne rally.
Can we talk about far-right extremism in Australia in general right now? So, like, how prevalent is it and how long has it actually been around for?
It might be worth just quickly differentiating extreme and radical elements of the far right. The term far right is an umbrella term. It's made up of two ideological subgroups, the first one being the radical right. So the radical right tends to reject elements of liberal democracy, like rights for minority groups and so on, but they essentially accept the fundamental underpinnings of liberal democracy. They're democratic in nature. Think Pauline Hanson, for instance. Conversely, the extreme right also reject those elements of liberal democracy, but they also completely disregard and reject democracy outright in favor of authoritarian modes of governance. So think Nazis. There's various groups that are currently active. The primary one is the National Socialist Network. They're the largest group at the moment. Extreme right in Australia has been around for a long time. It's a dynamic landscape. It changes regularly. In the scholarship, people argue that Australia hasn't had the same scale of extreme right mobilization compared to places like Europe and USA. And that's certainly true. One of the explanations that has been posited is that one of the reasons we haven't is because our governments have assimilated elements of extreme right thought into their, you know, political agendas, which has meant that those groups haven't risen in the same way because they haven't been able to point to gaps, legislative gaps within governments as an explanation for why they are relevant and why they are needed. The most prominent example being the White Australia policy. That is what a lot of extreme right groups would argue for, but it was a policy that was enacted by our government.
Is this growing? You know, are these, they've been around for a while, but are they getting more traction now? You said the White Australia policy was a big reason they hadn't got things. That's something that has been abandoned now by Australia, although there's obviously still remnants of it that exist. Are these groups getting more traction across Australia?
They are certainly more publicly visible. That's indisputable. They're certainly emboldened. They're pulling off stunts that historically they wouldn't have. They're getting a bigger audience and a bigger reception. I mean, the rallies on the weekend, I think, were a really good example of that, where the leader of the NSN, Thomas Sewell, was given a speaker position at the rally, which when I heard that, I was absolutely blown away. So I think in terms of their exposure, their reach, the amount of time, amount of airtime that they're getting has certainly increased. In terms of membership numbers, their membership numbers have probably stayed relatively stable. It's hard to say. It's hard to say perfectly whether that's the case. They're definitely more organized and have larger membership than neo-Nazi groups have had in, I'd say, the last 10 years, probably the last 20.
Just lastly, I mean, we saw flyers being handed out at these rallies over the weekend for some of these right-wing extreme groups. How important is an event like this for kind of bolstering numbers and recruiting people into a more organized far right?
It's hard to overstate the importance of these kinds of rallies. It is not a coincidence at all that flyers were being handed out at this rally in very much the same way that they were being handed out at anti-lockdown rallies during the COVID period. What these rallies present is a hand-picked group of people that have already significant ideological stances that position them very, very conveniently to be recruited and radicalized. So this was the same case with COVID and anti-lockdown. Things like anti-government sentiment is a really important part of far-right ideologies. Distrust in institutions and elites, whether that be academia, politicians, you know, the ruling class. The draw for these rallies, obviously, is you've got a demographic of people who are willing to march for a political cause, so they're politically motivated. They're likely distrustful and resentful towards the government because they see them as being one of the causes of, as they claim, mass immigration. And conveniently, they also happen to be dissatisfied with one of the core ideological underpinnings of the far right, which is non-white immigration. So you've got a very, very, very convenient demographic there. And we know that there's a reason that the National Socialist Network, one, had a hand in organising the rallies, and two, attended and spoke at these rallies because this is the perfect recruiting ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Callum, thank you so much for explaining all of that. That was really fascinating and, yeah, upsetting, but really good to like get an understanding of. So, yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Of course, you're more than welcome. It's been good fun.
Okay, so we've spoken a bit there about the far right in Australia, but we also wanted to speak about the politics of this specifically. So members of the government have spoken out about it, but I think it's worth looking at what the government can actually do here and what they are doing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have thought that there are rules, I guess, to keep people safe from ideologies that are considered to be dangerous in Australia.
And to look at that, we thought it would be a good idea to speak to an expert in countering violent extremism. So we got Professor Greg Barton to join us from Indonesia. Greg, welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
I think people expect that there's kind of some protection from dangerous ideologies in Australia. We've seen over the last 25 years or so some pretty extensive counterterrorism laws rolled out with pretty extreme powers for government and law enforcement associated with them. Are these laws fit for purpose to protect people from far-right extremism as well?
I think the laws are fit for purpose in as much as there's a limit to what laws can do, and our laws, we have some of the most extensive counterterrorism laws in the world, and that's because we've kept on adding to them every time we've had a problem, very understandable. But I think this is a moment when we need to take stock and acknowledge that legislation can't save us by itself. It's ironically, it's the legislators, not the legislation, that we need to depend on. And the legislators we get are only as good as the robustness of our democratic system. So, you know, the obvious case at the moment is that the second term of Donald Trump, Congress isn't functioning as people would hope it to function. So the executive is not held accountable by the legislature. And, you know, we're talking about neo-Nazi and far-right ideas. We have somebody who at the very least can be described as a white supremacist in Stephen Miller, who is the brains behind not just the Immigration Customs Enforcement Project, but you know, sort of one of the stronger ideological elements in the Trump administration. So long story short, America is really at the moment rapidly sliding into authoritarianism, anti-democratic government, and the guiding ideology, in as much as there is one, is this sort of white supremacist idea. And that shows us what happens, and we're a long way from that. Our elections this year showed us that we're a long way from that, thankfully. But it shows us that it's not our legislation that's going to save us, it's our legislators. And that's not to say that our politicians are great, it's just that if we don't take care of our democracy, we'll end up with something that no amount of tradition and even the Constitution, no amount of legislation is going to be a safeguard.
In terms of kind of warnings, Mike Burgess has been talking about this for quite some time and quite explicitly saying for some years now that homegrown kind of far-right ideologies are one of the biggest security risks that Australia is facing. Do you think the way that the governments or, you know, politicians have responded to that has been appropriate? Have they taken those warnings on board and done something to action them?
I think to a large extent they have. I don't want to suggest that our political system is completely broken. Once again, the single best line of polling that we can take as a reference point is you know, federal elections. And this year's federal election showed that there was clearly one camp pushing politics of fear, and that didn't succeed. So I think that's an important data point. But we still have a problem with people sort of playing with fire in our political discourse, whether they're elected officials, whether they're parts of the commentariat or talkback, radio, other, it's all part of an ecosystem, right? So it's not as healthy and as good as it could be and should be. We need to pay attention to that. The point is having this conversation and recognizing we need to really be careful about sort of the creeping advances of supremacist thinking, of victim mentality that blames another group, whether indigenous or Muslim or Asian or whatever the framing is, often all of them. This is a real threat for us. Members of Parliament, to be fair, legislators have responded to requests for more legislation. Both sides of politics, the major parties, coalitions, recognise this. So I don't think there's an in principle problem. I think it's more just that we don't always act consistently with what we say we believe. In other words, we slip back into dangerous rhetoric when we say that we recognise the danger.
I mean, speaking about legislators' involvement in this, obviously we saw a couple of MPs, including Pauline Hanson and Bob Katter, speaking at the March for Australia rallies on the weekend. I'm just wondering, like, is there particular concern around that, especially when Bob Katter was photographed holding a megaphone that was associated with a neo-Nazi group? He says that he wasn't aware of its association, but, I mean, surely there should be more discussion about that and a bit more of a spotlight on those activities.
Yeah, I think there's a few things we need to sort of take from this. One is that in a healthy, open society, we're going to have a diversity of opinion expressed. So think of it as a bell curve. Pauline Hanson and Bob Carter are out in one arm of the bell curve, right? I don't think we should respond by cutting off the arm of the bell curve. In other words, I don't think we should try and silence minority voices. But I do think we should hold them to account, particularly when they cross a line. And you know, Bob Carter is on that line at the moment, if not across it, and he needs to be held to account. Pauline Hanson regularly crosses it. We need to find a way to not demonise Bob Carter, nor to demonise ideas of people who are concerned about migration, but to hold them to account that, okay, if they want to express an opinion, they have to be very clear about what it is they're saying and not resort to dog whistling, not resort to sort of deniable calls to get populist support. Every politician wants to be popular, but populism is about playing to sort of base fears. It's about sort of an us and them mentality. And we need to really be on our guard to try and, as much as we can, make that a minority phenomenon, not let it come into the mainstream.
You've said that the legislation itself isn't necessarily the way to get around this, but it is part of the system that exists in Australia at the moment to deal with, you know, ideologies that are seen to be unfit for Australian society, you know, listing groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, you know, so that any association with them is a criminal offence. Why isn't a group like the National Socialist Network listed as a terrorist organisation? Surely if they're, you know, out attacking people or allegedly attacking people in public, it's a line that people might think, you know, association with an extreme group like that should be criminalized.
Yeah, I think those are really good questions. And there are some fairly clear answers, and not to say this is easy, but there are sort of a fairly clear understanding of how we need to frame things. So terrorism needs to always be understood as the use of violence to advance some political project, or it can be the threatened use of violence, but it's about violence and changing the world, a radical change. Now, groups like Al-Qaeda and particularly Islamic State in recent years have made it their whole reason for being that they are engaged in a violent struggle to change the world, to change the system, whether at a local level or a global level. The problem with the far right is that it doesn't work as coherently as, in this case, a Salafi jihadi Islamist extremism. With groups like Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, and of course there are others and local variants, generally the structure is fairly top down. It's sort of a paramilitary idea, and generally people swear allegiance to this senior leader. They swear a bayat, an oath, and that sort of makes the relationship very clear. So when they go and commit an act, they commit it in the name of that group. Almost all of the far right terrorist attacks that we can think of, including the horrible March 2019 attack in Christchurch, which involved an Australian terrorist, somebody who was a hateful extremist who overnight became a violent extremist, he was acting in his own name. He wasn't acting in the name of the National Socialist Network or any other group, or, you know, Proud Boys or any of such groups in Australia that he'd had previous association with. He was acting in his own name. He uploaded his own manifesto. The Christchurch attack was based on the 2011 attack in Oslo and in Torre Island in Norway, where in July 2011 you had an attacker who, first of all, blew up government buildings and then shot dead young people and children at a youth camp in cold blood. And that was referenced as the sort of the classic model. And we've had, you know, dozens of far-right attacks along similar lines. These are the two of the more serious ones, but there's been many such. And they're, in these cases, never in the name of a group, but in the name of an individual. And groups deny that, well, we knew this person only peripherally. We didn't sponsor this action. We don't approve it. So there's this plausible deniability and this messiness about the way the organization works. So the reason I think it doesn't make sense at this stage to look at the National Socialist Network in Australia and say, well, we're going to treat it the same as Al-Qaeda, Islamic State or other such groups, is because they're not making it unambiguous that they're supporting violence. They're sort of playing in this limbo space, and the people who do violence do it in the name of the individual, the actor, the lone actor, even though clearly there's an association. And that makes it really hard to deal with. But I do think our existing legislation is pretty much there. Some recent innovations, such as saying, you know, flying a Nazi swastika or, you know, trading in such paraphernalia is illegal. I think that's reasonable. I think also it's reasonable to have a ban on face masks in protests. But we need to recognise we're at the edge of what we can, you know, incremental returns, diminishing returns with legislation. And at the end of the day, whether these groups remain marginal, peripheral clowns or desperately seeking attention, hence it's a challenge for us even discussing them in the media, or whether they become mainstream in the way that Stephen Miller, who was the brains behind the Immigration and Custom Enforcement you know, it's essentially its government body, but it's becoming a paramilitary that does arrest people without displaying ID and wearing face masks, and clearly targets people based on racial profiling. And it's just in a recent Congress bill received money that will make it better funded than any military in the world outside the major powers like America and China. That's a really disturbing development, but that's because of a weakness, a sickness in American democracy. It's not primarily because of a failure of American legislation. It's the failure to enforce that legislation. So that's the lesson for us.
You mentioned there speaking in the media about the neo-Nazi movement and the danger of sort of legitimizing that, giving it a platform, making it seem larger than it is. And I suppose I'm wondering, like, what you think the line that we should be sort of walking is here when we're covering stories like this.
Yeah, I think we can't not cover them. So, for example, if we have the National Socialists marching down Bourke Street Mall in Melbourne, we can't just close our eyes and say, well, that's, you know, just a bunch of guys, nothing to see here, or we're not going to talk about it because they don't deserve attention. We've got to sort of have this conversation, but we need to frame it in context. So the framing is really important. And I think that's one thing we often get wrong in media reporting. We sort of feel we've got to be balanced, so we've got to both sides things. Well, both sides doesn't make sense if you're dealing with you know, violent extremists or hateful extremists, white supremacists. You've got to talk about them, but we don't need to have one of their spokespeople coming along or somebody sympathetic to them coming along. We need to find a proportionate way of understanding it, and also to put it in context. Some reporting could unwittingly, unintentionally give the impression that these guys are on the rise, and that's exactly the message they want. So it's not a question of whether we discuss things, it's how we discuss things.
Really interesting. Thank you so much for that, Greg. Really, really insightful.
No, a pleasure. I think it's really important that we're talking about this. I know that we don't want to give oxygen to the fire with groups like the National Socialist Network, but we do need to talk about it because at the end of the day, it's you know, I've said it's the health of our democracy, but the health of our democracy doesn't start with the people we elect. It starts with the conversations we have. And so media and the public discourse is a really important part of this. So it's entirely appropriate this is where we end up because we've got to constantly work on this. Otherwise, it'll slide away from us, and we can see examples of Germany, but more seriously at the moment, what's happening in the United States.
That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening.
We'll be back for another sitting fortnight in a while. It's probably going to be a couple of weeks now. But for the moment, follow us and give us 5 stars on your podcast platform of choice.
And we'll see you next time when we'll be breaking down the biggest news from Canberra.
See you then.
Bye.
Bye.